Today, comedy writing exists in more forms than ever, from pieces in The New Yorker to TV sitcoms, but also things like Twitter one-liners. In a new book called Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers, Mike Sachs interviews some of the best-known and most influential comedy writers of our day, including Mel Brooks, Amy Poehler, Mike Schur, Patton Oswalt, and Bill Hader. Mike Sachs joins us now, along with two of the book's contributors, both very funny, Adam Resnick, who has written for The Larry Sanders Show, one of my favorite shows ever, and Saturday Night Live, and Will Tracy, former editor-in-chief of The Onion. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mike, you're a journalist. Did you ever write comedy?
Yeah, I have. I mean, that's actually what I started off doing, is I wanted to be a comedy writer, and my dream was to write for magazines and then be called up to the majors and write for Late Night with David Letterman.
So what happened?
Well, it doesn't work like that. That's what happens.
There are no magazines. Basically.
That's right. There now are no magazines. But when I was starting, there was no internet, so there was all magazines. So I would freelance for Cracked and Mad and National Lampoon and things like that. And then it became progressively Vanity Fair, Esquire, New Yorker, GQ. But, you know, it came to the point where it just occurred to me where I'd rather stay in print than write for TV anyway. So I do write comedy for print, humor for print. But with these books, I sort of put on a journalistic hat and sort of take the back seat and let them do the talking. But it is more journalistic than what I normally do.
Do people who write funny appreciate other people writing funny?
Yeah, I think so.
They're not in competition?
No. My brother's an architect, and there's tremendous competition among architects. Very, very critical of each other's work. What I've seen with comedy writers, at least at the top, is that first and foremost, they're big fans of comedy. And they still laugh like they used to when they were growing up. So I think there's a real delight in laughing. And it's actually harder to make these comedy writers laugh now. So if someone does make you laugh, there's a real love for that person.
Yeah. Did you get to interview all of your favorites?
Well, there was a few who didn't get back to me or who said no. But everyone in this book...
You want to tell us who they were so that we can even scores now?
Well, let me preface that by saying that even... Sometimes the big names aren't big interviews. Steve Martin, Woody Allen, Albert Brooks... They've been interviewed a lot, big names. They would sell a book, but not necessarily the best interviews because they've done it a lot, and they wouldn't have 20 hours to talk with me and really go in-depth, Playboy, Paris Review-style interviews. So there were a few, those I just mentioned. Tina Fey did not get back to me, but it's completely understandable. These are people at the top of their careers, very busy, and it is a time. It does take a lot of time to get these interviews.
All of those people have been on the show, and none of them were particularly funny, so...
Really?
Maybe, yeah.
Were they trying to be funny?
No, there are people who are just funny. We had Joan Rivers here yesterday. One of the funniest interviews I ever did was the late Henny Youngman. He just was funny. Mm-hmm. He just knew how to deliver a line. Adam, how did you feel when Mike approached you to participate?
Actually, I wasn't so keen on doing it because I don't feel like I'm one to pontificate on comedy. I'm not, you know, even though I've done it for a living, I was never sort of a comedy geek or aficionado. I like, if it's funny, I like it. But I also
you must
like
think
all
of
types
the process, don't you?
In what sense?
Well, you know, when you're thinking about having to write funny and working with people and writing funny, you think about how the whole thing works. Otherwise,
yeah.
I mean, everybody thinks about the process of what they do.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't know if I think so deeply about the process. It depends what I'm working on. And the thing that Mike did, though, is he actually made, I think, it was interesting. It was a pleasure doing the interview, and it wasn't what I expected. When you look at the book, it is interesting to read about all the other writers and their processes and the things that everything that goes into it. A lot of stuff I didn't know about, and I found fascinating with some of these people, but it's, yeah.
How did you get started?
Actually, it was a fluke. I applied for an internship at Late Night with David Letterman, the NBC show. And
usually that means getting coffee for the writers.
Yeah, with me, this is a while ago, wasn't really that. Although occasionally I would have to get a soup for Dave, and I can remember on like a bitter cold winter's day bringing back the soup in a paper bag, and it would be leaking, and my hand would be scalded and that kind of stuff. But no, the good thing is I worked for Steve O'Donnell, who was the head writer at the time, and I befriended Chris Elliott and some other people there. And it was a small shop then, and Dave was very accessible and a great guy. So, you know, I started writing some stuff, and I submitted some things to Dave, and he liked it. Eventually, I was hired.
And then how do you wind up being hired for other things? Do you just apply for a job? You hear there's a, Gary Shandling is going to do a sitcom on cable.
Now, there's no set way that any of this happens. It's different for everybody. If I had not, called when I did about an internship at Letterman, I don't know, I'd probably be back in Harrisburg now selling insurance, like the rest of my family. But then from there it went to, then Chris was offered to do a show at Fox called Get a Life, and we were writing partners. So we wrote that, and it sort of happens from there. Things just happen.
And then Saturday Night Live, most of the writers also start off as stand-ups?
I don't know. My experience there was really short. I was sort of part-time for one season, and it was a season where they were having problems because
they've been having problems.
This one, though, was especially problematic because it was a very big cast.
What season
cast
was this? Who were some of the cast members? Do you remember?
Well, I just remember that guys like Farley and Sandler and David Spade, they were on their way out to do movies. Mm. So there was I think there might have been a little bit of a I don't know, the camaraderie's weird. Everything, it just felt a little bit wrong for that season. But, that show has the right to do that because overall, I think, the show has been great over the years. So it's allowed a season where you still have to find things. And that one was just, it didn't work as well. Chris Elliott was also on that season, and I don't think he felt quite comfortable.
Does each place you work at have a different comedic philosophy or approach?
That's the thing is I don't think about it that deeply, really. It's you're working for a place that's obviously something you want to do, so you think you can write there. If you were hired for it, they think you can write it. And so the approach wise, I guess, would depend on what the show is and what the tone is and things like that.
In most cases, you're writing with other people in collaboration, aren't you?
Sometimes. I usually don't. I mean, Chris Elliott and I collaborated on his stuff at Letterman and then Get a Life and things like that. So that's the only person I ever collaborated with, and it was just on Chris's material. Some writers are different. Some, there's writing teams. There's Mike, shoot me. This is getting boring. What should I do? Mike, someone jump in here.
No, well, we're going to go to Will right now. Will, what were your thoughts when Mike approached you about the show?
Well, Mike's an old friend of mine, so I felt comfortable with the experience. But in general, I feel like a lot of comedy writers feel a little bit embarrassed talking about process, because when you start talking really clinical about something that's supposed to be very silly and absurd and kind of free and fun, you kind of start to feel boring and unfunny. Dirty.
But then
starts to get not funny real quick.
Oh, there's plenty of jerks out there, comedy writers, that love to pontificate.
That's true. And they're usually not that funny.
Those are the ones you don't want to interview.
Exactly. Right, yeah. So there's a little bit of embarrassment with that. I think because of my experience working at The Onion, where we do have such a process there, and it's to a lot of people, a lot of our readers, very mysterious, I think that there is a little bit of fun to just sort of lift the veil and show people, okay, here's exactly how it's made. And so I felt okay doing that. But in general, I don't want to talk about my own personal, authorial style or process, because then I feel pompous.
Do you feel you
silly.
Have one, Will? Because
no,
I
don't.
I just, I write what I, what I want to write.
Well, I'm also different. I mean, Mike and Adam have both been very successful writing comedy and writing about comedy on their own. And I'm used to being on a staff of writers. And when you're on a staff of writers, whether it's for a television show or a website or a magazine that's comedy, you have certain advantages, things that help you out. First of all, it forces you to write every day. So you have to go to an office and you have to sit down and write comedy. You have no choice or you lose your job. Secondly...
And you have to be funny.
But you're helped a little bit because there are all these talented, funny people around. So you're not just in your own head wondering, is this... I have no idea, is this funny? There are people there to say, yeah, no, that's funny, or no, that's not that great.
Or could we make it better by doing it this way?
Exactly. And oftentimes something you work on is made better just because there's strength in numbers, so there's a bunch of other talented, funny people around to kick in ideas and jokes, and you can kind of pick the best ones. But it doesn't, in the end, often feel like yours. It feels like a consensus reached by a group of funny people.
You've written for, as we said, you were editor-in-chief of The Onion. I talked to Joan Rivers about the difference between writing for a performance and writing something for the page just yesterday, and she said the two were totally different things.
Yeah.
Because she knows about, she can act out certain things and get a laugh, whereas for the page, it really has to come as a total surprise to the reader.
And I also think some of the funniest Onion pieces ever, if you read them to a live audience, would just be dead, horrifying dead silence, and no one would laugh at all because it's not that kind of funny. a lot of Onion pieces.
I've laughed aloud at any number of
headlines. I think some of them you can. I mean, I think Onion, some of the really silly, absurd pieces you will laugh at. Some of the pieces that are, again, this sounds pompous, but more thought-provoking or more as much commentary as they are common comedy, maybe you don't laugh as much as you sort of laugh inside or appreciate them.
And now you're writing for John Oliver?
Yeah.
And so you're allowed to do that other more thought-provoking kind of comedy.
But also it's new because it's a live audience, and I've never written for a live audience before, so I'm learning how that works and all these, I guess, unwritten rules of what makes a live audience laugh or not, which I think is always changing.
I'm talking with two of the contributors to a book called Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. They are Will Tracy and Adam Resnick, and with Mike Sachs, the man who actually put the whole book together, did the interviews. It is published by Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Mike, Amy Poehler, and Kay Cannon, who wrote for 30 Rock, are two of the handful of women interviewed in your book. Do they still consider comedy something of a man's world?
No. I mean, those who do, Jerry Lewis, the late Christopher Hitchens, were derided, and rightly so. That just doesn't exist anymore. That's some of the best young emerging talent are women, and just phenomenal stuff.
Yeah, I agree. It's the best stuff today.
Phenomenal.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, but they are writing. Perhaps they've added a certain freshness because they don't write the same kinds of things always that men write.
Right, and I think for a long time Harvard Lampoon males wrote the same type of material, but I think anyone with any life experience different from the norm, whether they come not from an Ivy League or they're female or they're this or they're that, just adds to the comedy and adds to the freshness.
Adam, you said that you pretty much wrote on your own, or you wrote with Chris Elliott.
Mm-hmm.
So you weren't in the writer's room?
At Letterman, yeah. That was a
Letterman
big part of it.
Yeah, so how many people were working on the same jokes?
It wasn't like, it was sort of like, you know, there were like a couple of specific monologue writers and that was their job mostly. They also contributed other things, but that was just about Dave's monologue. And then everything else, you know, you came up with pieces. Yeah, a lot of time, the writer's room there was really good when I was there. I enjoyed the experience. When I hear Will talk about it, I think, yeah, I kind of liked that. I like going in every day and sort of have that order, you know, of work with them. But then we'd all go into our different offices and write our own stuff. Sometimes we'd partner up. It would vary.
But there is something to be said for going in and being around like-minded people, because writing comedy alone can be very insular, and you can circle the drain and just go down and down and down and sort of lose touch with what was funny to begin with. So to be able to bounce ideas and comedy off another person can only add to the comedy, and I think it's more psychologically helpful to the writer as well, rather than being totally alone and isolated.
It's also
the Dick Van Dyke show was based on that premise. Wasn't
it? Yeah,
that's
everyone trained. Yeah, I remember seeing those.
My mom still thinks that's my job. getting up on a desk and acting out a bit with Sally and
Maury Amsterdam.
You do that in your head, though, don't you?
That's true.
That really was like the thing that, I mean, that didn't make me. I never really thought about being a comedy writer, but I remember when I was a kid seeing those reruns and thinking that job, you know, just looks great. Just to hang out in that room, it just looks like fun. I wasn't aware really about them having to write jokes. It was just
deal with executives or anything.
And then you learn it's much more like how the writer's room is depicted in Larry Sanders' show, where it's sort of a certain amount of frustration and tedium and bitterness and knowing that, well, this might play. It's not the best, our best work, but we'll put it out there.
Right, you know? Exactly. Yeah.
I have a friend who just went out to Hollywood who had written alone. He's now running for TV, and he compared the writer's room to being on a jury duty for a month. Or, you know, however long he's there. So he's there in front of people, and he's not quite comfortable with how that feels yet. It's a different type of writing for him.
The Larry Sanders Show played on the same idea, only it felt a lot closer to the truth.
Yeah.
Not that the Dick Van Dyke Show wasn't brilliant in its own right. He got a lot of laughs out of it. But the Larry Sanders Show were the people who had actually worked on talk shows. Is that how they got so close to what really goes on?
Some of the people, there were some other, like Paul Sims was there for a long time. He wrote for Letterman. I was there the last season. I think there were some people that floated in and out, but it wasn't really necessary. I always saw that show really as, I mean, for me, it clearly is a comedy, but I always thought of it as a drama, you know, that was funny, you know, and that's what I love about that show.
So even though you've all said it's difficult for people to explain what they think is funny and what isn't, you obviously do have thoughts about that. You just expressed one, in fact.
Yeah, I guess, well, no. You know, I like when it's real. I like when things are not supposed to be jokes, per se. Like things that are like a Hal Ashby film, like The Last Detail, is a very funny movie, but yeah. It's a drama. That's what I prefer over just jokey comedy.
So are you disappointed with the way sitcoms have become just a joke every minute?
Well, no, the
and
good
half.
Ones are good. Look, if you go the great ones like Seinfeld or something, those are, you know, as far as a network sitcom, that's great. But then you have things like you know, Louis C.K. and that show is just brilliant. Again, I see it, that to me that it's, you know, drama first. No one would see it that way, but maybe drama first about the funny guy. But it's that's
and what this year's series has become very controversial because of the drama part.
Yeah, it has. I think it almost seems to me like that's what he was going for, is like, you know, you thought, I'm going a certain way, I'm going to go another way. And he's doing what the Ricky Gervais did and a lot of other people. He's likable but also unlikable at the same time. But, you know, in down deep, he's just very, very human. He's very, very real. And I always prefer that, too, rather than a character who is created out of jokes from comedy writers and that is not tethered to any reality. Louis C.K. is, to me, very real. Even when he is unlikable, we're all unlikable.
And he hits a woman.
Very unlikable, right?
Yeah, and his don't you think, in his, those episodes, I hate when writers say, comedy writers often do this, if they're doing a show, they like to say, this is great cliche, they're really like short films every week. The Louis C.K., those do feel more like short films, yeah. But a lot of people, like, they have to say that. I don't know, it sounds loftier, I guess, you know, that they're really short films. But well, actually, I think he could take it. I think if Louis C.K. said that, I would agree. That.
But he used to shoot short films. I remember him shooting comedic short films. Years ago, and that's the thing about Louis C.K., if you want to see how someone succeeds, you just don't stop. You put your head down, you don't stop. He has had...
I could never do that. Isn't it amazing that he
does that? Well, yeah, it's amazing. For 20 years, he's had his ups and he's had his downs, yeah. But he just kept on going, and finally people have caught up with him. Yeah.
Do you think that it's made possible because he is not on one of the major networks? In fact, so much of the best comedy seems to be... either on the pay cable networks or on networks like FX.
Yeah, the best comedy is usually executive free, whether it's Monty Python or the early Simpsons or The Onion. They didn't have to answer to anyone except themselves. So when you have executives going in there, an executive would not have allowed what you were just talking about, Louis C.K., that specific episode. But he needs to do what he needs to do, and he needs to either achieve or fail on his own right. And to have that freedom now, I think, is a tremendous thing in comedy.
I want to come back to that after we take a little break. My guests are Mike Sachs, whose book, Poking a Dead Frog, is published by Penguin. And he speaks to many of the best comedy writers in this country, including two who are here with him, Will Tracy, and also Adam Resnick. Is it just because you're the only ones available?
Yeah, I think they were. We live close by.
These guys are real cheap. They'll do anything.
We will take a little break. Oh, by the way, Adam Resnick also has another book I should mention called Will Not Attend from Blue Rider Press.
Great book. Loved it.
Be back right after this.
I loved it.
And we are back with Mike Sachs, Will Tracy, and Adam Resnick talking about writing comedy. They are all contributors to Poking a Dead Frog, conversations with today's top comedy writers. And I want to get to that title. But first, before we went into the break, Mike, you were talking about how all great comedy has managed to navigate executive meddling. And all the writers you interviewed have approached comedy in their own way, but have to been aware of the executive meddling.
You have to play the game. I mean, there are certainly a ton of great comedy out there, Seinfeld, that had great executives. But really, across the board, the happiest comedy writers are those who do what they want, how they want to do it. And there's more opportunities now to not go through executives, to put out your own film, to put out your own stand-up. And to have complete editorial control.
Do you think things have changed over the years? The Smothers Brothers had real problems with censorship.
Right, and they paid for that.
Yeah, but Saturday Night Live in the early years, but they don't seem to be bothered these days.
But then sometimes it's also good to have a little something to push against. even if it's not much. Sometimes it's good to have some sort of, oh, so-and-so is telling us not to do this, or this advertiser, we can't upset them, or something where you kind of feel like there's a foil.
Right, too much freedom can be difficult.
Right. Yeah.
But the matter of political correctness comes up whenever comedy is discussed. Why do you think some people are offended by what's obviously intended to be a joke?
Who wants to tackle that?
Well, no, not all people are, right? There's some people.
I said some people.
Some people.
I mean, some people think Don Rickles is great. Other people walk out. Well, Joan Rivers, anytime she comes on our show, half the email we get is from people saying, I love her, she's just so hilarious. And then we get a few saying, why did you put that woman on?
Well, I think the difference is in the past, you could walk out and you say, I don't like Don Rickles, I don't like Joan Rivers. Now there seems to be this feeling that if I don't like something, it should not exist. If I don't like a certain show that deals with a certain topic that offends me as a whomever, then it should not be on the air. And that seems more prevalent now than it used to be.
Yeah, I'm one of those people, by the way.
I know you are.
Rickles is an anomaly, though. He's the one guy who seems to be able to get away with anything still, and everyone agrees. It's okay if Don Rickles does it. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's an odd thing. But I don't know. I think that sometimes it's merited when people are upset. Sometimes it's not. It really depends on what the intended target or who the intended target of the joke was.
Well, I was interested in reading a review recently of Dave Chappelle's new show in which the critic Hilton Alls complained that he has become too middle of the road, that he's just not as cutting edge and as outrageous as he was in the old days when, according to Hilton Alls, he was good.
But David Chappelle is brilliant and he's doing what he feels needs to be done. So if he wants to go more quote-unquote middle of the road, then that's his creative prerogative. I don't think anyone should.
But people are paying a lot of money to see the Dave Chappelle thing.
Sure. Well, I don't know. Maybe a lot
they were going to go see.
But it's such an individual creative endeavor for him to go on stage and talk. And this may be where he is right now. He may be in a point in his life where he's a little older. Maybe he's in a relationship. Maybe he has a child. Maybe he wants to go in that direction.
Not maybe. He really. Those are all true. Yeah.
You know what I think it is, Mike? I think he plays with our expectations.
Teases us.
Yes. I think that's true.
And yeah, that's
so there
right.
you go. It's unanimous.
In addition to interviews, there are sections in this book called ultra-specific comedic knowledge and pure hardcore advice, which gives some advice to young writers, descriptions of what it's really like in a writer's room, and explanations of what makes a good piece of writing. Adam and Will, do you wish that you'd been given that kind of advice when you were starting out?
Well, I feel as though I was. My first thing I ever did was The Onion, so I was immediately your first month of
you
writing
grew
for
with
The
it.
Onion. Yeah, and your first month of writing for The Onion is it's tough. It's a gauntlet. They put you through it, and you kind of learn very quickly. Here are the things we do. Here are the things we don't do, which I actually think is helpful. I think a lot of writers' rooms, they try to be very, very encouraging, and it comes out of that sort of improv philosophy of yes anding everything, and no one ever says no to anybody. And at The Onion, you're very clearly told, no, we don't do that. No, that's not funny. And maybe that doesn't hold outside of The Onion, but within The Onion, they give you clear rules. And so I felt like I learned very, very, very quickly.
But what happens when somebody says, no, that's not funny, and you think it is very funny?
Well, you're upset. But then I also felt like if there are 10 other people in the room who I think are really funny and no one else really likes it, then I'm going to guess I might be wrong on that one. And I also am insecure enough that I never feel that married to an idea and that precious about, no, this is great. If other people don't like it, I feel more embarrassed and I shut up.
Improv is all about being funny in a group. Are there rules there as well, or do you just have – done improv?
The thing about the writer's room, too, it sounds like you have a really good writer. I've been in different writer rooms. Some are better than others. Some, everyone's great, and there's a real – and then some, there's always a couple of idiots that you can't stand, and other people feel the same way. So and they're like, always guys, by the way. You know, guy comedy writers,
yeah,
when they're idiots, I mean, there's nothing worse on the planet, and there's a lot of them.
But they keep – they keep on being hired.
They could be. They have so many different methods. So many different methods. The ones that think they're funny are the worst.
Yeah, right.
So right. It really is depends on just that feeling in the room. And I've been in different types. And one like the Letterman one was great.
Yeah, I remember in that Christopher Hitchens piece, his big argument for why men are funnier is that men for some sort of because of some biological imperative, have more of a need to be funny. And to me, that seemed completely backwards, because there's the people who desperately need to be funny are some of the unfunniest people in the world.
Exactly.
So that always seemed like a really counterintuitive argument to me.
If there's a desperation there, the audience can tell immediately.
Right, exactly.
Adam, you have written a book I mentioned earlier, Will Not Attend, Lively Stories of Detachment and Isolation.
Mm-hmm.
The title suggests that your path to comedy was rather difficult and lonely.
Well, there was no path, actually. I never really considered being a comedy writer or a writer. I grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and my family, you know, was not a lot of culture in our house of any type. But it wasn't until...
But you watched things.
Oh, yeah. No, I watched everything. I watched a lot of old movies and stuff like that. But sure, I watched, you know, all the big show, the iconic shows like SCTV and SNL when it started. But as I think I said, as Mike pried out of me in his book, one of my biggest influences is probably Paul Henning, who created Green Acres and the Beverly Hillbillies. The reruns of those shows growing up meant more. I don't think I've laughed at anything harder, and will still laugh at them if I see them. I think the writing was brilliant.
Great.
And I guess it's different for everybody. I guess it's a blend of stuff for me. But.
Well, you give samples of rejected and published headlines from The Onion. Can you explain the process of deciding what works and what doesn't, and why some of them were rejected, like studies, majority of Americans covered in layer of crumbs was rejected, or only way to prevent guerrilla attacks is bigger gorillas everywhere, says NRA head?
Yeah.
I think that's a brilliant headline.
Well, and that last one was amended so that I think I actually say that. I don't remember what the exact wording was, but we eventually use a different wording of that, which is something that does happen. I think the number one reason why things will get rejected at The Onion is because The Onion's already done something very similar. And so you're basically just, as I'm sure they have the exact same problem at The Simpsons every day, where it's like, okay, we've been around for 20 years. We already made a version very, very close to that. And so although this is funny, we can't do it. And that's what happens at The Onion all the time.
Letterman, same thing.
Yeah,
all the shows like that.
Right.
You know,
but there's a really defined voice. There's probably a chance that you've done it.
On the other hand, probably most of the audience won't even be aware that that was done before. The only people who know that it was
people,
done
the writers group,
are
yeah.
the writers.
No, exactly.
And the people that do know that, it's just sad that they
Yeah, and that's something you talk about, but it's also you have to make this choice that we have to be original. We can't do that.
But can you overthink it?
Yeah. No, it's. I think you overthink it all the time. And then there's stuff that I look back on my editorship of The Onion. There's stuff that I know, like, yeah, we could have done that thing that I, for some reason, vehemently was against us doing. That probably would have been really funny.
Can you recycle part of a joke and still have it be funny?
I don't know. If once something feels in your head old or feels in some way, a writer's room can make an idea seem really toxic really quickly. And someone will make a cutting joke about how, oh, this is very similar to something so-and-so said, or this is the standard joke to make, but, you know, it's funny. And then it poisons the whole room, and no one wants to touch that joke anymore.
One of my favorite headlines during the 2008 campaign was, Black Guy Asks Nation for Change.
Yeah. It was a clever one. Every once in a while, yeah, I think that there was a search to get something that felt really, really clever, and it was all encapsulated right there.
Carl Reiner has been on the show a number of times, and he always talked about how, in fact, Dick Van Dyke as well, how they would use things that happened in their lives as basis for their comedy material. Is that typical? Did that happen on Parks and Recreation, shows like that?
I don't know. I mean, I think people sometimes, you know, definitely you bring in things that you know, and or I assume when you're pitching stories.
I imagine Seinfeld was awesome.
Yeah, that's a great example.
And well, Larry Sanders must have had a fair amount of that, right?
Yeah, there was definitely things that actually happened that people knew about that sort of happened based on stories that happened on late night talk shows.
From what I've heard, the Dick Van Dyke show was one of the first where Carl Reiner were go into the writer's room on Monday and said, tell me what happened over the weekend. And by doing that, it's what we were talking about earlier. If the jokes are connected to character and to humans rather than just free-floating, I think it lands harder and it tends to not get as dated as quickly. Like, I can still watch The Dick Van Show today and I think it's as funny as it was when I was a kid. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, sitcoms probably need that stuff more because they're situation comedies. You need situations, and so you need people to come in with things that feel real.
Although the only film that 100% people say they loved and will still love is Airplane. I don't know why that film still makes people...
Naked Gun's funny, too.
Yes.
But it's very well written. Those types of jokes, they were very, very well written. At that time, it was just a blast. It was completely...
Yeah, you wonder why people can't do that anymore.
It's hard. I mean, there's...
Well, they do a lot. I mean, there's like scary movie type movies. That's an offshoot
similar
of Airplane.
Right.
Yeah,
you see
a joke every 10 seconds kind of parody.
But a bad joke every time. I mean, with the original Airplane, those jokes are really good. But
it was also based on situation and situations that we knew. Right. We were seeing variations on films that were big at the time, like Airport and films about fires on ships and skyscrapers.
Right. I mean, these very serious films that were in the cultural literacy that we hadn't seen mocked before and was done really, really well.
Where does the title of the book come from, Poking a Dead Frog?
It comes from an E.B. White quote, which basically he's saying, it was just in New Yorker. He compares analyzing comedy to dissecting a frog in that it can be done, but the frog will die from it. And I understand that. I think a lot of books about comedy are written by people who feel that A plus B equals C. If you do this, if you do that, if you do this, you'll become a success. And I've never really felt that way. I do think there are some common themes across these interviews, but I don't think there's any book out there or any course that you can take where you can learn not only how to be funny but how to be successful as a comedy writer. I think what I wanted to do was just go straight to the source. How did you, as a successful writer, how did you achieve success? It was a mystery to me. How does one do that? And that's what I wanted to do with this book.
And don't you think in the book it confirms what I thought? I think the through line in your book. There's no answer. There's nothing for anyone to learn. That's what's fascinating.
Well, that's
about
just it. It's like joining the carnival. You know, you're not getting your PhD. You're not getting your doctorate here. You're totally off the path, and you're in the woods, and you have to figure it out for yourselves.
But there are comedy writing courses, aren't there?
There are, but they're usually taught by people who once submitted one spec script.
They're robbing
to 2.5
people,
minutes.
Essentially.
And Adam, you say there's too much comedy. What do you mean by that?
Oh, when did I say that today? Yeah, too much comedy. Yeah, I don't. But it does feel like it. Well, but the thing is, what's great is great. I think it was a few years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago. It really felt too much comedy. Now I guess it feels like that. But there's so much. There's a lot of great comedy, especially on cable, and a lot of smart people are emerging. I hadn't really seen, I would say, in the last 10 years. So it has become like a, when you say it's a bigger thing than it was. I know when I started at Letterman, I think Letterman was one of the beginnings for all the comedy.
Because now there's so many cable networks places like Netflix are trying to have original content, and there's places like Twitter, then there's web series, so there's so many more.
So there's going to be more of better comedy, but also more of garbage comedy.
If you were looking for somebody to write for The Onion, would you look at Twitter? Because
I mean, I'm not sure
like headlines.
What they're doing now, but I mean, it's something you can't ignore. I think there was a time when I maybe was I was a little bit more.
You seem saddened by that a bit.
We have to end it here. Unfortunately, my guests have been Mike Sachs, whose book Poking a Dead Frog is published by Penguin, two of the contributors, Adam Resnick, and also Will Tracy. And it's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thank you very much.
And now we're going to go and analyze what was funny.
Yeah,
poke that dead frog.
Too much funny.